good to know. Yeah.
Welcome to the Babbelry,
where translators visit the Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel.
Babel.
Babbelry.
And that's pretty much who I am. If you tell me I can't do something, oh, you know, woe on you, because I will do it. I will absolutely do it.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. A theme that runs through many of my interviews is how people respond when they encounter obstacles. In our culture, we have a tendency to think that all obstacles need to be removed. And certainly in this episode, we're going to discuss some obstacles that many Americans face that should be removed. But there's a value to obstacles. When people respond to them in a positive way, by working harder and being more committed to their cause, they achieve a clarity of vision shared by our most valuable leaders.
My name is Ladaris Hazard Cordell. I'm a retired Superior Court judge from Santa Clara County, California. I'm also a former independent police auditor for the city of San Jose. And I'm currently involved in taking steps to make sure we keep our democracy and also indulging in my love of music. And also I'm the author of I call it a primoir, part primer and part memoir about my 20 years on the bench as a trial court judge.
Ladaris's barrier-breaking career happened in part simply because of barriers that shouldn't have existed in the first place. But overcoming these obstacles with resolve, grace, and careful thought has led her to be an exceptional advocate, not just for a better, more equitable legal system, but also an advocate for music, for art, and for civic engagement. Ladaris was one of the trio I interviewed in December 2025 about the nonprofit she co-founded, the African American Composer Initiative. The music you will hear throughout this episode was performed by Ladaris and others live at their concerts. This is a person who has harnessed her curiosity, wide interests, and varied experiences to build a fascinating and meaningful life. I started by asking Ladaris about how her unusual book, her primoir, came about.
I was a trial court judge for just about 20 years, and it was the worst job in the world and the best job in the world. After I finished my 20 years, I really wasn't thinking about writing a book at all. But what I had written were letters to my parents during my last 8 or 9 years on the bench. So every Friday, I would sit down in my chambers and type out a letter to my parents about everything that happened that week. Why did I do that? Because my parents loved hearing about all the cases that would come into my court. And if you're a trial court judge, just about every day is something unexpected happens, which was great. I mean, you don't really get too bored being a trial court judge. There are some boring days, but mostly not. And they loved it. So I just started writing every Friday. Why Fridays? Because trial court judges generally don't get cases on Fridays. That's usually the day where it's kind of a cleanup day, but also when you get the files for the next week. So you have time to kind of review the files. So they weren't letters for my parents to write back. It was just, this is almost like a journal kind of thing for me. These were real letters, signed them, put them in an envelope, postage stamps. There was no texting. There was no emails, none of that. And it was good. It was cathartic for me just to kind of write about when I had good days, bad days, and in between days. All right. So I retired from the bench. That would have been 2001. And I went back east to visit my parents. I grew up just outside of Philadelphia in a suburb called Ardmore, which has a very interesting history in terms of race relations. So I go back to visit my parents, and during the visit, my mother, who was a very organized person, pulls this box out of the closet, and she says, "What do you want me to do with these?" And I'm like, "What are they?" And I looked. She didn't have to tell me. She kept every letter that I wrote. So I didn't make copies of the letters. I wrote the letters, mailed them, and that was it. Very personal letters, too, because I wrote about what was going on in my life as well. So I boxed them up, mailed them back here to me. And it took me 2 or 3 years, Suki, before I decided, let me take a look at these letters. And what I read was stunning to me in that I didn't realize I had presided over so many cases, just the last 8 years, and also just the variety of cases over which I had presided. Now, why was that surprising? Most trial court judges tend to gravitate to developing an expertise in one area. So if a judge likes doing juvenile law, then that's what they want to do, and they kind of stay in that assignment. I wanted to be an all-purpose judge. I wanted to try everything, and I did. In 20 years, I presided over every kind of case you can imagine, from adoptions to name changes to criminal cases to people suing each other to probate to family court to mental health, where people are in locked psychiatric units, and it takes a judge to decide whether or not the person who wants to get out can get out. So I just did it all and wrote about it. So I get the letters, I read them, and that's when I start thinking, you know, given all of the crap that I see on TV with these TV court judges, there's Judge Judy, very entertaining, but totally not based in reality. And there are so many of these court TV shows on where people are laughing and judges are acting like buffoons. And I'm thinking, you know, this job is a very serious job and an important job. And that's when I started thinking, you know, maybe I can write something, write about this. So the sad thing that happened is that my mother died in January 2020. I was in the middle of writing that book then, so she never got to read it. My father had died a few years earlier, and which is why I dedicate the book to their memory. My parents would have loved this book. They would have loved it. I write very personally, so it isn't some academic treatise. And I also decided if I'm going to write a memoir, I'm going to write truthfully. And I'm no saint. There were mistakes I made, things I think I could have done better. And I write about all of that because I don't want to waste readers' time. I want to write honestly. I want to write truthfully about what it's like to wear that black robe and to be an African-American woman who is gay, who I was the first African-American female judge in all of Northern California, and that was in 1982.
Ladoris Cordell wasn't what you would call judge material in the late 70s. Though she was assistant dean at Stanford Law, which was unusual enough, there were very few women judges and vanishingly few black women judges. She said that the career path hadn't even occurred to her before the day she received a phone call out of the blue.
I didn't know this judge, and he said, you know, I'm trying to bring diversity to the courts, and we have a system here where you can just be a judge for a day, and you could preside over a small claims case. And for people not familiar with small claims, it's great because it's a court where you can't have any lawyers. So it's people suing each other. At the time back then, it was up to $5,000. Today, it's up to $10,000. No lawyers. You just come into court, both sides, and you come before a judge. This was called being a judge for a day, or a pro tem, Latin for the time. Okay. And so, can I put your name on the list? This is a wonderful person. I eventually got to know him. And I said, sure. I wasn't thinking about it much. And then, I don't know if a month or two goes by, and then I get a call. Your name's come up, and it's just a random thing. And can you come down and preside over a small claims case? And I'm thinking, sure, why not? So on the appointed day, I show up in the courthouse. I get the robe. I like the robe. I put it on. They give me a file. There's not much in it. There's only one piece of paper in it. It has the names of the people suing each other. So I walk into the courtroom. It's empty other than for the two litigants. And, you know, this is small claims. It's not a big deal. There's no bailiff or anything. So you go in. So I walked in. And then I stopped and I looked and I stared. And the litigants stopped, looked at me, and they stared. And then I was like, what? So it turns out that the litigants were two black women. One was suing the other to get paid for braiding the person's hair. And the person who got her hair braided, the braidee, said, no, I'm not paying her because she did a lousy job braiding my hair. So I'm like, oh my goodness, what the heck? So, of course, I knew the subject matter, being a Black woman myself, and I knew what to do. So one of the things, as I write in the book, I asked the person who had her hair braided and refused to pay, I said, would you approach the bench, please, and so I can examine the hair, the evidence. She says, of course. She comes up, and I know what to look for. I know to see if it's braided properly. Is it neatly done at the roots? And so after I looked, and she actually let me touch her hair. I asked for permission. I knew where to go. She sat down. And so I listened to them both. And then I made my ruling. And my ruling was that the person who had her hair braided had to pay, but didn't have to pay the full amount because the braiding really wasn't that great. And so they both looked at me and said, thank you, Your Honor. I made my decision. Off they went. And I sat there and I'm thinking, this is, you know, I don't really believe in fate. Not really, but how else to explain a random case and a random pull where I come up on the wheel to be the pro tem judge, and I'm presiding over a case where two Black women, where the subject matter is right up my alley. Mm-hmm. And then as I'm driving home, I'm thinking, you know, what if this had been at the time, and still is, the typical, let's say, white male judge? He wouldn't have had a clue. No, what to ask or anything, which drove home to me the importance of having a diverse bench. Wherever, whatever state it is, even in the federal system, we need judges from diverse backgrounds. So it was on that drive home where I thought, you know, I enjoyed that. I liked that. I liked making decisions when people could not on their own. And that's when my journey to look into becoming a judge and eventually came to fruition 2 years later. That's how it all started.
Can you talk a little bit about what you were like as a child and what your interests were and what you majored in college, which had nothing to do with the law?
Well, actually, it ended up having to do with the law in a roundabout way. So I am the middle of three. I have two sisters. And my mother used to say to me and to other people that I was properly the middle child because I always ended up in the middle of things, in the middle of things. And she'd laugh about it. So I guess I was precocious. My sisters and I grew up in a Black community in Ardmore, which is on the Main Line. If people don't know what the Main Line, it's a very wealthy chain of suburbs outside of Philadelphia, and they call it the Main Line because this train would run from, I don't know if it was past New York, come down to Philly, and it was the Main Line. And then you have all of these very wealthy families, old money in this country, living in Ardmore, in Marion. So there are these communities. And Ardmore was a segregated community in that there was just, you know, wealthy white folks. And then there's the Black community, which was the, we provided the service for the white community. So my grandmother, both of my parents' mothers were domestics. They worked for wealthy white families, cleaning their houses, taking care of their kids. Generally men, Black men in the community did service things. So I had an uncle who ran a chauffeur service. My father ran a dry cleaning business where many of his clients were wealthy white folks on the Main Line. So I grew up in the Black community. However, where the county and city district lines were drawn, my sisters and I, and those of us living in the Black community on the street where I lived, end up going to predominantly white public schools, very good public schools. One of them was called like Haverford High School because we lived near Haverford College and Bryn Mawr College. We ended up getting very good educations, but we also ended up being the only, usually one or two, or maybe the only Black kids in our classes. So I learned to grow up living in two worlds. I excelled in school in a white world, and then I'd come home and be in a Black world. And when I grew up, my white friends who were students did not come visit me, and I didn't come visit them because you didn't do that. I grew up in a Black Baptist church. My sisters and I grew up singing in the church, and we would just, I have no idea how it happened, but we all got the music gene, and we would sing three-part harmony a cappella, no training, nothing, when we would go on car trips, road trips with my parents. So that was me growing up, excelling in you know, the predominantly white schools, living in a world that was predominantly black, and having parents who did not have the opportunity to go to college, but said to their three daughters, you're going, it's only a matter of where.
Where for La Doris Cordell was Antioch College, which offered an unusual program, sending students out into the world for 3 months at a time. La Doris started to understand the structure of racism, especially when she left to study in Mexico for her Spanish major.
So my sisters and I all went to college, and my sisters and I went on to each get graduate degrees. I ended up in the law. But like you said, I was in college and I wasn't thinking about the law. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And fortunately, I went to a college where you only went to school for 3 months at a time. You had to leave. Every 3 months, you have to pack up and go somewhere in the world and learn from the world. And that was Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. No grades, because the idea is you learn for learning's sake, not to get a grade. That can be a problem if you apply to a law school like Stanford, where they want to see your grades and you don't have any. But I wasn't thinking about law at that time. I'd never seen a lawyer of color, and there were none of these court TV programs on TV. So I started off majoring in Spanish, Yo Puedo Hablar Español, and then I lived in Mexico, in Guanajuato, and I studied at the Universidad de Guanajuato. I came back from that experience very disillusioned, because I saw racial discrimination that I and my family and all the folks that I grew up with experienced in Mexico, where the indigenous, darker people were the domestics, and they were treated horribly. You had the lighter-skinned, more Spanish folks in Mexico having all of the money and the wealth. And I came back like, what is this? What is this thing about melanin? And why can't people with the melanin be treated more fairly? And why are we always without? So I came back and disillusioned, and that's when I changed my major to theater. So I majored in drama and speech, and I loved it. I just loved it, being on stage, but also behind stage and directing plays and doing all of that. The problem was, it's time to graduate. What am I going to do? I did not believe that I was the kind of person that could just go and try to make it in Hollywood or New York or Broadway. No. And so I kind of ruled out things. I'm not a science math person, and I ended up with the law.
The hitch was that Antioch didn't assign grades, which made getting into law school tricky. La Doris was rejected from everywhere but one of the top law schools in the country, Stanford University. The West Coast was a shock, as was the new environment La Doris found herself in.
I'd never been on the West Coast. I come out here. My mother said to me, I really go to law school, but not there, because if you go, I don't think you're ever going to come back home. And I said, that's ridiculous. Of course I'm going to come back. Did I come back? No, I did not. But theater, I ended up being a litigator. And litigation is theater. It's theater. Who's the audience? The jury, or sometimes just the judge when you have a court trial. And your job is to persuade. That's what actors do. That's what you do in theater. Make them believe you. So it was perfect for me, the training that I had, and even better being a judge. And as a judge, I'm the producer director. You come into my courtroom, that's my house. You stand up when I come in, you sit down after I sit down, and then you talk when I let you talk. And if an attorney's going on and not making any sense, counsel, I've heard enough, please sit down. And what do they say? Yes, Your Honor. And they sit down. So it was, when I look back, it was perfect training for me to go into the law and to do the litigating and then end up being on the bench. When I was near the time to graduate from college, the whole Black Power movement had started. So I had gone from wearing straightened hair to, I had a huge afro by the time I decided to go to law school. And again, it's just me, you know, I'm being me, not thinking about what that environment's going to be like. The only Black woman in my class with a big afro. No professors of color at Stanford Law School at the time. No women of any color on the faculty. And my first year, I was terrified. I was just terrified. Why am I here? It was the whole imposter syndrome. What am I? I don't deserve. What am I? And I eventually worked through all of that because there turned out among that faculty, there was no faculty of color. There were some good people who said to me, you deserve to be here. And you just have to figure this out. And then it was the determination. My parents basically instilled in all three of us, you can do anything you want to do. It's not going to be easy. And I had seen their struggle. They dealt with Jim Crow. I heard stories all about them and their parents. And as I said, my grandparents were domestics. So they said, it's not going to be easy, but so what? So go that route if you want to do it. So that was it. And that's pretty much who I am. If you tell me I can't do something, oh, you know, woe on you, because I will do it. I will absolutely do it. So the hard part for me, Suki, was that I go to this, you know, top law school, I graduate, I get a law degree, and none of the corporate law firms would hire me. I go for these interviews and I'm thinking, this is me, I got a Stanford degree, and they're like, not happening. So as my parents taught us, where there seems to be no way, make a way, find a way. So I opened my own law practice right out of law school. In a community, East Palo Alto, that never had a lawyer, ever. No private lawyer ever. And so I had to buy a building. I didn't have any money. I did. Bought a building. Then I had a mortgage and I had student loans. So when I was there, there had never been a lawyer in private practice. The community embraced me. I got my start in the law because the community embraced me. I opened a law practice. And I just had to take anything and anyone that came in the door. So someone right out of law school, I'm doing divorces, I'm doing criminal cases, I'm doing civil rights litigation. If looking back, I had to be totally insane to do what I did, but I didn't have a choice. And I was young. I think I was like 22, 23, and decided this is what I have to do. That I don't have a choice. And I had that law practice for 6.5 years. And that's the practice that sustained me. So you have to also add in, during that time I got married. I'm long since divorced, but I got married. And then you have the biological clock running because I thought, well, maybe I want to have a child or two. But how do you do that when you're starting your law practice? You just bought a building, you have a mortgage, and you have law school loans, and yet I figured that out, and I had my daughter number one when I was 25, and then daughter number two when I was 30, and it was hard, but I was young looking back now, and somehow I managed to do it.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. Retired Judge LaDoris Cordell had a groundbreaking career, but what does that really mean? It's a personal achievement for her, but for us, the public, the bigger achievement is the integration of more diverse viewpoints into a part of a system that touches all of us. LaDoris's primoire, a memoir called Her Honor, details how her background and experience made her a more thoughtful judge. But the last section of the book goes in a very different direction. She points out 10 problems in what she calls our legal system, because justice is a work in progress. I asked her to focus on two of the issues from the book that she thinks are particularly important for the public to understand. The first is the election of judges by the public, a political process for a job that shouldn't be political, which is practiced in a surprisingly large number of states.
So one thing that happens to me is that the night before ballots are due, I get phone calls from neighbors like, do you know who this person is who wants to be a judge or wants to be reelected? Who is that? Just tell me who to vote for. I'll talk to the person, but it just hit me, and it continues because this is ongoing, that we know so little about people in black robes whom we elect who have all this power over our lives. Judges have an amazing amount of power. So you're coming in for a divorce, a judge decides who gets custody or how much child support or spousal support you receive. Judges decide on adoption. I mean, there's just so much. And we voters know so very little. And I will tell you, judges like that. They don't want you to know. And people who are running can say whatever they want. And we just don't have a way to find out who these judges are. So you get your ballot, you open it up, and you see a profile. It's a like two paragraphs about the candidate, either someone who wants to be a judge or someone who wants to be reelected. And you look, you read it and like, wow, that's very impressive. Of course it is, because they wrote it themselves. There is no objective information about the people who want to wear these black robes. I told you earlier, judges are not, we're not politicians. Politicians make promises to do whatever their constituents want. And that's fine. That's what politicians do. Judges can only make one promise: to uphold the constitutions of their state and of the United States. That's the only promise judges can make. But in fact, that's not how it works. So what happens, and I point this out in the book about judicial elections, is that millions of dollars are spent by corporations, businesses, lobbyists to get voters to vote for the person they want, because that person will owe them. That person will rule in favor of businesses. And that's not how it should work. And what happens during elections, as I write in the book, judges are influenced. First of all, they have to raise a lot of money. Well, who gives them the money? Where are they getting the money from? From lawyers. And those same people then end up appearing in their courts. It is a huge conflict of interest. Second, we now know from studies is that elections, during election seasons, that judges are influenced by elections in their decision making. Mm-hmm. So judges become tougher in real law and order during election seasons, because they don't want to people to attack them, and maybe someone challenge them when election comes up. So who suffers the most when judges decide, you know, I'm going to be tough and I'm not even going to think about leniency and sentencing or whatever? People who tend to suffer most are poor people who generally don't have lawyers, or they have overworked public defenders, and also people of color. So during these election seasons, poor people, people of color, get sentenced more harshly than ordinarily they would. So we need to get rid of judicial elections. The problem is, once people have something, it's very hard to take it away. So right now, people are like, no, you know, we should have a say in, you know, judges we elect, but you don't even know who they are. So as long as we have elections, organizations like the Leagues of Women Voters should do as much as they can to inform people about who these judges are. Well, how do you find out? Well, you can Google and put their names in and see if something comes up. You can find out if judges, if these people have ever been disciplined. But more needs to be done. So that's one fix. It's not really a fix. It's just more information. The big fix is stop these judicial elections. Instead, have people who want to be judges and people who want to continue to be judges go before merit selection commissions that have voters on them, that have lawyers, non-lawyers. So not political. They have to be bipartisan. And some states do utilize these merit commissions. So there's reasons why we need to move away from elections. And the reason I have credibility to talk about this is that I was initially appointed to the bench by, back then, Governor Brown 1.0, right? And then I ran for election to move up in the system. I won, and it was a horrible experience, but I won, and I write about that in the book. So I know of what I speak when I say, no, elections are not. You don't treat judges like politicians, mm-hmm. because we are not and should not be.
It's interesting to think about what the, I usually say downstream effects of this are, but the, as judges rise up in the ranks, who makes it up to those more powerful lifetime positions, and probably the ones who are better at politics? And that would lead me, at least, to think that they're the ones who are probably more beholden to the moneyed interests that you mentioned before.
No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely. It is money that has become the centerpiece in determining who sits on the bench. That should never be the case. And I think back in the day, it didn't used to be the case, but it is more so now than ever.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how, you know, when you look at so many of the problems that we can't seem to solve, it just seems so often that there's money underneath it. We've always been a capitalist society, yet there was a point at which it seemed like things were still, you know, nothing was ever perfect or free of influence of money and powerful people. But now it seems like it's all coming to a head, that anything I talk to someone about, they eventually come to people with money.
Yeah, and when you think about it, just look at the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, they make so much money writing books, taking gifts, and it's just, this is not the way things should be at all. It's not a money-making proposition. I don't think judges should be allowed to ever publish books while they're still on the bench. They can't write about any of their cases because you're prohibited from writing about what you're presiding over now. So, you know, write about their lives. Do that when they retire. Now they get these big advances, multi-million dollar. What is that? That should not be what the judiciary is about. And of course, they haven't had ethics rules because they were too arrogant to think that they should have them. Now they have them. They're not enforceable, but it is a step. When they leave, they're much wealthier than they were when they came on the bench. And that is just, I think, a total, you know, distortion of what should be happening in our judiciary, mm-hmm. in the states as well as in the federal system.
Retired Judge LaDoris Cordell has seen our legal system under more and more pressure as politics and social media have mixed to form a particularly volatile stew. She just spoke about her discomfort with transforming judges into politicians through elections, and now she takes on one result of that process, the loss of judicial independence.
Judges are targets of violence in the federal system and in the state system. Judges who make decisions that people don't like are targeted on social media. They are threatened. They've had to leave their homes. They've had to go into hiding. And that's just a serious, serious problem. And it's all about this thing called judicial independence. And what is that? I mean, some people think that just means judges can do anything they want. And like, no, that's not what judicial independence means. It means going back to the American Revolution. It means looking at what happened when King George III controlled the colonies here and also controlled the judges. And one of the grievances filed against King George by those here in this country was that he controlled all the judges, did everything. So this country was founded on giving judges independence so they were not beholden to anyone. But we're seeing quite the opposite now, one under this current administration in the federal system, where judges appointed under this administration are doing whatever the person in charge wants. That's not judicial independence. But looking at the states, this is where it's even more serious. I personally know of judges who have had to go into hiding because they made decisions entirely lawful, entirely, that didn't please either a group of people or a person when the threats came. So the biggest problem is really judges having to deal with social media. I can make a decision, but it can be distorted, edited, and posted on social media, and it's not what I said at all. And yet here people come after me. So we have something in California called recalls. So any politician, it's one sentence in the California Constitution that says basically the people who are elected can be recalled by the electors. But they've lumped judges in with that. So judges get treated just like politicians. And what has happened is that there are recalls that have happened, and there are some going on now, Contra Costa County and Southern California and LA, where people just don't like the decisions judges made. Judges have discretion, and so they're being targeted. And so this whole recall thing, I don't believe recalls should be abolished for judges. I'm not saying that. The fix is that there should be specific criteria certain requirements that have to be filled before a judge can be targeted for recall. Not just because the judge made a decision I didn't like. No, it's because the judge actually committed malfeasance, maybe was convicted of a serious crime, or otherwise engaged in serious misconduct. Yes, then there are some judges that shouldn't be allowed to serve out their terms, and we need to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. But you should never, ever recall a judge because a judge made a decision that you with which you disagree. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening around the country, and it's happening in California. And it destroys judicial independence. Another study was done of six counties in California to see how the judges responded when just the announcement of a recall of a judge, this was in 2018, his name was Aaron Persky, was targeted for recall, and he was recalled. But a study was done on judges in six counties to see if their sentencing behaviors in criminal cases changed just by announcing that there was going to be an attempt to recall the judge. And the results of the study were astounding and horrible, in that judges completely gave harsher sentences, were harder on criminal defendants, and that the people who suffered the most were people of color and poor people. Mm-hmm. Just announcing it. So we need to change this, and the only people who can really change this, it's the legislature, and or if there were a constitutional amendment, then it would take the voters to do that.
The Aaron Persky case is particularly interesting because it was tied to his decision in a sexual assault case that had received huge amounts of media attention. I was reading something recently about this tension between most liberals and most liberal feminists want two competing things. One is for the law to take assaults against women more seriously and to try to deal with this problem. And the other is to have more fair sentencing, have the law be applied more equally, have the law applied in ways that follow the law rather than just punishing one person because of, say, their skin color, their gender, whatever. And so in that case, it seemed like both of those things were actually at odds.
You know, judges take an oath to uphold the law, and not just the laws they like, even the laws they don't like. So when I took the oath and then I had to impose sentences on three strikes cases, which were 25 to life, I thought it was the most draconian law ever in California at the time, and yet I had to follow the law, and if I did not, then I needed to leave. And eventually I did. I retired because I could not continue to impose sentences 25 to life for these three strike cases. All right. So there are laws, and if people are concerned that laws do not sufficiently deal with sexual assaults, then the way to deal with that is to change the laws. Judges cannot do that. So change the laws. How do we do that? We go to the legislatures, and if they don't do it, you vote them out, you put people in who will change it. So the other thing is judicial discretion. The beauty of judicial discretion is that judges are not computers where we just plug it in. Okay, person did this sentence, and that's it. Some people would like that, but that's not what our system says. Our system says judges look at the totality of the circumstances. Look at who this victim is. Look at who the perpetrator, convicted person is, and then consider a number of factors. And then you decide, here's the range, what to impose. And that's what happened in the Persky case, where the judge made a decision using his discretion to impose a sentence that people did not like. Not everybody, but some people did not like. And it was entirely lawful. So what can people do? Well, you can appeal. When the judge's time for re-election comes up, you can say, nope, we don't want you, vote them out. But the recall was utilized because the judge made one lawful decision that people didn't like. So there goes your judicial independence. Because what judge is going to do what the judge believes is the right thing when the judge thinks, but you know, if I do that, then some people are going to be upset, and then I might be the target of recall, so I guess I'm not going to do the right thing. And that's what is happening. Do we want a system like that? No, we don't. The other issue you brought up, however, was that of built-in bias. Like, why are some people getting more harsh sentences than others for the same crimes? And that's happening. And it's happening based on race. It's happening based on gender. So what has California done? Recently, California enacted the Racial Justice Act. The whole purpose is to weed out racism in the criminal legal system. And you notice I call it a criminal legal system, not a criminal justice system, because justice is a work in progress. We're not there yet. We got a way to go. But, you know, we're making some progress. This act requires judges specifically to, when you recognize that racism has come into play, either in how prosecutors are charging people with certain crimes or in jury selection, where maybe people of color are getting excused off of juries using peremptory challenges, or when people are sentenced, that harsher sentences are going to people of color. This act addresses that, and California was the first state to make this happen. So efforts are being made to make the system more fair, but we have quite a way to go. But all of these issues about the law being more fair, about judicial discretion, these are issues that, you know, I just hope people, if they read my book, they'll understand. I mean, I had to utilize discretion in imposing sentences, and it's hard. And you try to do what's right. And that's the best we can do as judges, which is why I said it was a great job, but it was also the worst job, because I had terrible days and I had wonderful days.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. Retired Judge LaDoris Cordell has been busy with her music, art, and activism during her retirement. We'll talk about that next. But first, recently she completed one last job that has deeply informed her sense of where the United States is going, culturally and politically. This job was of great interest to the public. She investigated allegations against San Mateo County Sheriff Christina Corpus, who had the multiple distinctions of being the first woman and first Latina elected sheriff in the county, as well as the first sheriff to be removed by a county board of supervisors in California history. Her removal was necessitated by her refusal to step down in light of glaring evidence of misconduct, which LaDoris was engaged to investigate. The facts LaDoris uncovered were not so surprising, but what LaDoris found stepping into a controversy in the age of social media has firmed her resolve to help fix what has been broken.
What I was doing was conducting an independent investigation into allegations of misconduct by the sheriff and also by her close friend, I'll put it that way, someone whom I deem she had an improper personal relationship, who was employed at the sheriff's office. So there were people who were very supportive, and there were people and some in the mainstream media who were not, who consistently attacked me. And did it on social media. So I quickly learned, don't go on social media. Just don't do it. I was concerned at some point, sometimes, about my own safety. And fortunately, those concerns were not realized. But we're just living at a time where, and this is the case generally, leadership sets the tone. Leadership. National leadership sets the tone. So if you recall back when Obama was the leader in this country, the tone was one of trying to bring harmony, trying to shore up people who always felt disproportionately not represented to be recognized and to be of worth. Then we look at the current administration and the tone. The tone is harsh. The tone is say whatever you want to say, attack whomever you want to attack, and that's okay. It's okay. Be angry. So I received a lot of that anger. So in terms of my being a retired judge, and the reason I was hired was because I had a reputation for being objective and not pointing fingers and taking sides, that somehow didn't seem to matter to these folks. It just didn't matter. So, you know, I went on that journey. I did the investigation, and it is done. There is a new leader in the sheriff's office. And from my point of view, things are good. Things are better. So once again, nobody said change is easy. It's not easy. And that's why change just nationally in this country, it's not easy, but it has happened in the past and it will happen now. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Mm-hmm. The thing that is so disturbing to me is the reports that situations like that, what you suffered during that, is making people more hesitant to do public-facing jobs that have to be done. We need people to do these jobs. And that gets back to the judicial independence, just the fact that do people want to get into a job where they might have a crazed lunatic come to their house and shoot their son? I mean, you know, we're starting to get in a situation where only the unqualified people want some of the jobs, and that's not a good place to be.
Oh, I mean, you make such a good point on this. And I was thinking about this the other day, and I thought, if I had the opportunity to be a state court judge today, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it because of the atmosphere right now. And I was fortunate. When I was on the bench those 20 years, there wasn't the social media thing going on. Had there been, I don't even know if I would have lasted back then, because I made decisions that I believed were right. You know, you make such a good point that the people who would be wonderful on the bench are having second thoughts. I know this. They're having second thoughts. Why would I go down that road when I could be subject to all of this stuff and even, you know, maybe be harmed? Mm-hmm. So you get folks who maybe, you know, not as motivated, see it as a way to just kind of hang in there and, man, it'll be a nice retirement and then I can just go do what I want. I'll just do whatever just to do it. We don't need that. That's not what we want. But I do, however, know of judges who are there right now in our state courts here in California who are stepping up, who have courage. And I just applaud them so much. They are really good people, and they are people from all kinds of backgrounds, white, black, Latino, Asian, they're gay, they're trans, and they are there and fighting the good fight.
As time moves along, building your voice, it's still strong. You let the world know we must.
LaDoris Cordell is making the most of her retirement in part by making up for lost time when it comes to the aspects of herself that were somewhat neglected during her years on the bench. You've been listening to music she has performed as one of the founders of the African American Composer Initiative.
When I ended up going to college and into law school and then opening a law practice and then working at Stanford and then on the bench, I didn't have time for music. It was just, you know, being a mom, earning the money, and then the law. That was it. I didn't come back to music until I had retired from the bench and I started thinking, oh, you know, I want to go back to piano. I want to get going on piano again. And I didn't have a piano. I think I had an electronic keyboard or something, and it happened. I mean, I found the right piano teacher to get me back into music. And music is now, it's my safe place. It's my happy place. It's the place where I find solace. I mean, I've always loved music. I've always, you know, listened to music, but actually playing it again, getting back to vocalizing has just wasn't a part of my life for so long. And now it's central to keeping me balanced more than anything. And then co-founding the African American Composer Initiative with Jody and Deanne, Jody being my piano teacher, has changed everything for me. It's just, I always have my safe place where I can just calm it down, given everything that's going on in the world, and be okay.
You say that you didn't play music while you were working, but you did do art. And what was that about? And talk about your doodles and your cartoons and also your very beautiful portraits that you do.
Well, thank you. Art has always been a part of my life, and I don't know where I actually got it, but when I was a kid, I loved drawing cartoons, sidewalk chalk, and my parents loved it because I would do designs out on the sidewalk. And so when I got to law school, I remember I started cartooning because I'd see things there and I'd want to make fun of them and lampoon them. So I ended up drawing cartoons that actually got published in the student law school newspaper. It's so interesting because I talked to some professors later who kind of held their breath to see who I was going to do caricatures of each time the paper came out. And then when I was on the bench, believe it or not, sometimes it just got boring when you're doing your umpteenth drunk driving case and you're like, oh God, here we go. And they're picking the jury and I'm paying attention kind of, but I've done it. I could do it, you know, in my sleep, and I didn't sleep, but I was just like, oh, so bored. And that's where I would doodle, just draw things. And I ended up drawing things that were right on the bench by the microphone, you know, books or whatever. And I've just ballpoint pen, just draw them. And then I graduated to doing caricatures of the jurors and the lawyers. And I just kind of look at the jurors and then I draw, and I'd have to look away if they looked at me, you know, kind of so I didn't want them to know. And I remember after one trial, I decided to show them the little cartoons I had done. They were done during their jury service. And so I started doing legal cartoons. What are legal cartoons? They're just cartoons that lampoon the legal profession. And I drew them so that you would have to try to guess what the legal term was. So I did one where a person was sneaking in to the courtroom, a sort of burglar, and was grabbing the witness stand and tiptoeing out. And what was the legal term? It was called, you know, take the stand, because you have to, okay. So there are a bunch of them, and their cartoons are on my website. I donated them to a nonprofit that provided legal representation for juveniles. And they then put the cartoons in calendars and sold them. And the first year, they made more than $10,000. They were a big hit. So the next year, I did another set of them. And I write in the book how that got me in trouble because I ended up having a complaint filed against me for not showing enough respect for the legal profession, which is ridiculous because this was just parody. So anyway, the cartooning just kind of took off. The calendar sales went crazy. And then I like drawing more serious. I like doing charcoal portraits. I've never taken an art class, never. So I just draw what I see and figured out how to use charcoal. And I don't know how to paint or anything because I've never taken the time to do that. But I like drawing portraits and hands. Hands I really like. And one fun story is I drew a portrait of Judith Jameson.
Yes.
She was the artistic director of the Alvin Ailey. I drew a big picture and I have it on the wall. And I was able to get backstage at Berkeley when the Alvin Ailey troupe was there. And I took my drawing up and she saw it and she signed it. I have it right on my wall. And then she asked me if she could have it. And I said, no, you can't. I'm keeping this. And she had signed it for me. She loved it. It's just a hit, you know, portrait of her. Beautiful woman, mm-hmm. Just gorgeous.
When I look at people like you and the arc of your life, where you started your higher education and career just after the Civil Rights Movement, you had a career as a queer Black woman that was exceptional. You lived in a time when you were helped by that judge calling you and saying that he wanted diversity, and you were able to help others. This country blossomed in so many ways in those years, and now there's this contraction.
I remain ever hopeful. So this is why I get up in the morning, because it's so easy just to curl up and like, oh, forget it. Because in the morning I get my phone and I doom scroll. I just look at the New York Times headlines and I shut it. I just shut it and like, why get up? So I am ever hopeful. I am compelled forward because my maternal great-grandmother and great-great-grandmothers were the enslaved. How in the world can I lie in bed and moan when they were the enslaved and had nothing, nothing at all, not even their own bodies? I mean, that's the motivation. And so I love history. History is so important. And I watch and read about what has come before us, what atrocities, what good things have come before us. And I absolutely, absolutely firmly believe that we will get through this challenge, this threat to our democracy. We, meaning we the people. I just want to stress, I'm not Pollyanna-ish. I'm not like, oh, everything's going to be wonderful. No, this is not easy. Trying to keep a democracy is not easy. And I'm one of those, I took it for granted my whole time growing up. Well, we have a democracy. I mean, yeah, we have the racism, we have the sexism and the homophobia, and we have so many people who are fighting against it. That's still the case. The bigger threat now is that the leadership in this country is setting a tone that is allowing forces that heretofore were below the surface to surface and come out. They've always been there. They've always been there. You know, my parents raised me to always be prepared. When the door opens, step through it. And at the same time, you better never forget that you're standing on the shoulders of all these folks who sacrificed so much to get you where you could do this. So my concern now and my whole focus now is on getting people to do one thing, just one thing that can change everything, and that is to vote. That's it. And I tell people, do you understand why so much time and energy is being spent by this administration to suppress the vote? Do you get that? Other things are distractions. They're important, but they are distractions compared to what their real focus is, because it's the one thing that saves a democracy. So that's what I'm about. I mean, I talk about it as much as I can. For the last 14 months, I've joined a nice sized group of ours just behind where I live to protest every Saturday and Wednesday out. You know, I have my little mini megaphone and I'm pleading with people to vote and to people to understand that we're there for everybody. I don't care what your political bent is. We're here for everybody. So in my old age, it's like I'm seeing this whole circle, you know, this cycle, and it's coming around where my great-great-grandmother, and then coming around my parents, Jim Crow, and then me, you know, coming through Black Power, Civil Rights Movement, and then Obama, you know, coming around, and then we're here where there's just been this surge. So I see it. It's part of history, and I'm tracking it. So where do we go from here? Well, we certainly don't give up. And we certainly don't. I know George Clooney, he had just said, well, I'm going to live in France. Well, good for you, buddy. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, like Black folks built this country. Why am I going to leave it? Why would I run away? No, you don't like, go. You know, if you don't like our being here, you leave. But I'm not leaving. And is it scary? Absolutely scary. Absolutely. And so how more scary could it be to be enslaved? I mean, seriously. So no, you know, we'll handle it. And it doesn't mean I'm cavalier, not at all. But at the same time, you know, the worst thing you can do now is to be indifferent. Just be indifferent. Be a bystander. That's the worst thing you can do. The absolute worst. I mean, you can call me names and all. That doesn't even mean anything. Be indifferent. Stand on the sidelines. No, unacceptable. So as my parents drilled that into us, I drilled that into my children, my daughters, and my grandchildren. Uh-uh. You will not be indifferent. You will get your education. And you will never be a bystander. Ever. So that's what I'm about, with my art, with my music, with my legal work. With my legal commentary, that's exactly how I spend my time.
I never cared much for moonlit skies, never winked back at fireflies. But now that the stars are in your eyes, I'm beginning to see the light.
Many thanks to Lodoris Cordell for speaking with me, sharing her perspective and her art, and expressing her deep commitment to diversity, engagement, and justice. You can hear more about her musical life in the Babel Rees December 2025 episode, Not Forgotten Anymore. Find links to information we discussed in the show notes at babelree.com. Billy's song is by Valerie Capers with lyrics by Lodoris Cordell, performed by Valerie on the piano and vocals by Lodoris. Dance from a Deserted Plantation by William Grant Still features Lodoris Cordell and Jody Gandolfi on piano. I'm Beginning to See the Light by Duke Ellington was performed by Lodoris and Valerie Capers. All music was presented by the African American Composer Initiative, AACinitiative.org. Thanks for listening.
Now when you turn the lamp down,
I'm beginning to see the light.
Used to ramble through the park,
shadow boxing in the dark.
And then
you've been listening to The Babel Rees. The Babel Rees is produced with support from KSQD Radio in Santa Cruz, California.
Find us on major podcast platforms or at babelery.com.